Thank you. Bridget Hogg from HR Development at Work. Kylie, my question's for you. I think that managing the talent in a business is absolutely vital. So I wondered if you'd like to just tell us a bit more about your global talent management system.
Yeah, sure. The way I'd start that is it was hard yards. We looked at some of the core people platforms and decided we would go with a tailored build that we designed in-house and then outsourced to a technical provider. What it does is it basically has all the bells and whistles. So it is effectively covering succession, development, career aspirations, REM, all of the specialist areas in your business. But the key thing to this system, whilst it sounds quite boring, is that it enables you to do endless number of and searches. So you can actually start to get a really good view of A, your workforce, but B, when you're trying to fill roles on such a volume scale that we are, it actually enables you to identify who are the potentials. And what we do is we basically send out to employees a web form. So they control the information that goes in terms of their aspirations, et cetera. It's workflowed through to a people leader, and then it comes back into the system. So it's proved to make an absolute difference in the way we do talent management. So I'm happy to sort of talk about the provider and how all that worked if anyone's interested offline. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I think there's a question down the front.
Mike McGrath from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Can I just start by condemning you for getting rid of spreadsheets and the underlying data? On a more serious note, I think you know, the numbers that I'm aware of indicate that there is a vast employment pool that's continually missing out on the benefits of economic expansion. So with three significant employers at the table, I'd ask what, in your opinion, needs to be done to ensure that the benefits flow on to, you know, from the defence injection and the like in the state to the Aboriginal population of the state. What, in your opinion, do they need to do? And what, in your opinion, do the service areas and businesses themselves need to do as a matter of priority? Thank you.
Perhaps if that's a question for each of the speakers, is that... Yes. Perhaps start with Greg at the...
I'll be frank, I don't know. That simple.
That was going to be my response. One of the things that I've noticed certainly in coming into NAB for a relatively short period of time is, you know, we deal with a white-collar workforce, yet I think sometimes we don't realise the voice we've got in the broader... you know, economy, if you like, or broader community about, you know, the influence we can have about some of the skill shortages in other areas. So, you know, happy to say we're doing some work, but I certainly think we could be more proactive in the way that we try and influence that, particularly outside of the university-educated skills. We've certainly been doing some work around the Indigenous piece, but I think it's something you, in our partnerships in Alice Springs, it's something you need to be really careful with. And if you don't get it right, the repercussions are really, really strong and negative, and it's not something you should just rush into. So, you know, we're being pretty careful the way, you know, in terms of the way we look at that, so that both, I suppose, expectations of both parties are being met.
Yeah. All right. It's an interesting issue, and I think as a particularly big organisations, well, all organisations really, you should be good corporate citizens as much as you can, try and influence the wider community things. I mean, I'm on a subcommittee of the Business Council on Education and Innovation, and you know, making, I suppose, putting some points forward in terms of the educational process and the like are one way of doing it. We do a bit with Indigenous communities. We try and help skill not just people who work for us, but Indigenous communities generally about job opportunities and the like, how they might go to tender for a licensed post office, those sorts of things. I think the alliance with schools is very important in all those areas. But, yeah, it's a difficult issue, and as I said, I do think organisations do have an obligation to look at beyond their own boundaries.
Shall I add a comment to that? This is not from an employer's perspective. Most Indigenous people are not in Indigenous communities. They're employed as regular Australians in regular employment. In fact, their bosses don't even know that they're Indigenous. There is a lot of survey evidence that shows when employers are asked, do you have any Indigenous people in this organisation, they say no. And when the employees are asked, are you Indigenous, 5% say that they are. You see, so the truth is that what we see, and it is a very, very serious problem of Indigenous communities, is really a problem of isolation from the mainstream community and economy in Australia. And if there is an example of the significance of skills to your employment prospects, it is surely Aboriginal communities, because I have been to places in the Northern Territory where the teachers wait at the school for somebody, anybody, to show up. And this is, we're talking primary schools here. So, the situation is really, something has got to be done about this. It is just unreasonable. And it does look as though something is being done, and I think it's about time. But isolation from genuine employment prospects and having zero skills acquired is no way to get into the future.
Down here.
Thanks, Jess. Hilary Winchester, University of South Australia. Just as an example, just following on that question, I mean, as an employer, we have an Indigenous employment strategy. We have a clear target that 2% of our employees should be Indigenous. There is a difference, as Dick says, between those who self-identify as Indigenous and those who don't. But nonetheless, we're pretty close to our target. We use a lot of trainees who are not graduates, but we also have graduates. So across the general staff, professional staff, and increasingly in the academic staff. The retention, the strategy is quite simple. It's firstly about getting them in the door, and you have to work hard at that. And we work with government departments, and we work with Mission Australia to do that. And the second strategy is about retention, and we do that through development. And every new Indigenous staff member has 20% of their total employment cost allocated for specific development needs, which is negotiated through their manager and is in their performance plan. So there are things that every employer can do. It doesn't matter what occupations, what area of industry you work in. And I'd encourage, you know, every employer in the room to be actually tackling this with a real strategy and real targets.
Can I just add to that, just talking perhaps in the employment situation, we've always had a very big focus on Indigenous employment, and as I said, we've got just over 600 people. The issue, and that's people who are working for you, though I think the question was more about beyond pre-employment almost, but in terms of employment, I think what's been important for us is that each of our states has an Indigenous employment coordinator who is Indigenous in themselves. And that's very important in helping in terms of the retention and dealing with the cultural issues that can arise with individuals. I think the other important thing is, as employers, is just sharing the knowledge and of what organisations are doing. And my understanding is there is an increasing instance of organisations putting together Indigenous employment type strategies. All of that, I think, does assist.
Hi, Matthew McMahon from P&P Bitumen. My question's to Richard. Richard, I was interested to see in your future stats that it looked in 20 years' time or so, it'd be very difficult to find people you know, if you've got a degree, your chances of getting a job are extremely high, where if you didn't have a degree, you know, it drops right off. You know, right now in today's society, it seems like it's easier to find an accountant or a lawyer than it is a plumber or someone who lays bricks at the front of your house. Do I read that as in 20 years that might change? You know, like the blue-collar type worker is going to be easier to find? Or am I misreading those stats?
We've had an incredible construction boom, which has put a lot of pressure in that sector, so that's sort of come to the fore. I think that all the work that I'm aware of says that while this gets a lot of publicity, what people don't see is the incredible take-up of people with degrees, for example. The higher the qualification, the more competitive you are in the labour market, the more options you've got, and so on. So that I think is just sort of grinds remorselessly forward. Now, at various times, you'll find that there are particular skills that also come into sort of sharp focus. But I think the message is that the demand for skill is going to be remorseless. Now, if we don't train the people, there are other solutions. For example, the internet is an absolutely marvellous instrument for having skill shortages solved by what's now known as offshoring, for example. So if you need your tax returns done, you may think that they were done here in Adelaide. They weren't. They were done in Bangalore or somewhere like that by somebody who knows a lot about Australian tax law, and this is happening in America, and accountants that I know say they're being approached to be the front for that sort of thing. Same with diagnostics or anything. I mean, there are plenty of skilled people around the world who are able, with the internet at their disposal and with rearrangements of the way this negotiation takes place, to meet the skill requirements of advanced countries like Australia. The tragedy, I think, is that currently about 20% of our school kids leave school at below year 11. That's in South Australia. And the future for them is going to be tough in the sort of job market that we're looking at. And I think we do have to try very, very hard to bring about a situation where they get to a position where they are capable of getting some post-school qualification.
Perhaps while you're just moving across there, we saw that Greg, or we heard Greg talk about ASC looking overseas to fill some employment needs and an important program there. 2 weeks ago, we had in South Australia Minister Andrews announce that South Australia would keep or maintain their regional migration status. And that was warmly welcomed across the board and seen as the program had been a success. And we saw through Dick's figures that migration into South Australia has been positive or trending upwards. Perhaps this is a question to Kylie and also to Rod. We've heard, Greg, that ASC is looking at overseas migration or overseas workforce to fill some of their needs. How has NAB and Australia Post looked at that, or how are they dealing with that issue?
In some ways, we've started with our organisations, our regions in the UK, New Zealand, Asia, and New York. So that's given us a really good platform to work out, A, who are we looking to source and why, and is it based on a short-term secondment, or is it actually permanent employees that we're looking? So even looking within our 40,000-strong workforce, a lot of our moves have actually just been in rotating people around and through the partnership that I mentioned with the organisation that maps our external market. That's where we've started to actually source, and that's been more tap-on-shoulder type sourcing from the global market. But I suspect that may change. That might look quite different for us in the next sort of 5 to 10 years, but that's what we're doing at the moment.
Yeah, in
terms of us, I mentioned when I was talking about the situation we're facing resource difficulties in WA, and one of the things we've done is to look at making an approach under, I think it's, just checking with Rich, I think it's section 457 is the provision that allows you to employ people from overseas. And we would want to employ people, be able to access some people from overseas as potential posties, for example. The difficulty is that there's a restriction in relation to the type of skills that are allowed under that provision. You've got to make a case that the skills are of such a nature. But it's something that we are looking at doing because there's a necessity. Just the other thing, I was talking to a major recruitment firm recently, and they said they were actually, this is a recruitment firm in Australia, they were going to England to try and engage recruiters to come back here. So that shows how difficult it is. Thank you.
Carol Gaston, the South Australian Ambulance Service. There's an issue that it's sort of like it's an undercurrent. It's not often discussed. And I'd like to put it to the panel, perhaps, Dick, in the first instance. We talk about a skills shortage, but we actually have a lot of people in the workforce who have more than one job. Some of them are working in large industries, but at the same time employed in small business. If they're unpaid, we call them volunteers, and if they're paid, we call them moonlighters. And I'm just wondering if anyone's given any thought to how we might sort of address or even capitalise on this ambiguity.
Like to perhaps if we start without dobbing anyone in, we'll start with you, Dick, and then move in speaking order.
Clearly moonlighting's a jolly good idea if you want to solve a skill shortage, because it means that there are some people who have at least some of the skills that you need that become involved in meeting the shortage. So, as an inveterate moonlighter myself, that's what happens to you as you get to my age. You moonlight. Getting more flexible employment arrangements is a very important method of meeting all sorts of difficulties in the labour market. I was very struck with the example of Australia Post. I thought they were right on the money in terms of addressing this problem, because people don't come in one size fits all. They come as themselves, wanting to do their own thing and so on. And if you can, any employer that can accommodate that, if you offer part-time work, for example, you shouldn't apply restrictions to your employees that they can't do anything else with the rest of their time, unless it's in some sense a conflict of interest with the work that you're currently giving them. So I think those flexibility in employment is going to be an important method by which businesses address their skill shortages that are coming up.
I think it's obligation for us to look much more flexibly than we've had to in the past about how you employ. And sure, we might like a particular part of the workforce to all work uniform hours or to work with a uniform way of doing things, but I think we're going to have to be much more adaptable to doing that. And some people prefer to work full-time. Some people prefer to work 1, 2, 3 part-time jobs. And we're just going to have to adjust for that if this current trend continues, and it seems almost certain that it will in terms of labour scarcity. But I don't think there's any easy answer other than to be flexible, and that's just going to require a different way of thinking, some more risk-taking by organisations.
Could I add just one further comment? See, we've been here before. We've had skill shortages before, particularly in relation to the mining industry. I remember in the early 80s, we had the, sort of the last one. Everybody, employers were screaming their skulls off that they couldn't find metal tradesmen. And I remember addressing a crowd in Melbourne of enraged employers wanting the government to send another more 100 container loads of metal tradesmen into the country from wherever. And I'd just done some work on the census, and there were, you know, 100,000 metal tradesmen in the labour force driving buses and God knows what. And why did they do this? Because it was their best opportunity. And they were so lockstep, the employers, they couldn't see how to winkle these people out from whatever they were currently doing. I remember I said, we are retraining metal tradesmen now at Flinders as economists. And they didn't think it was that funny, actually. But so you see, there's lots of potential there of if people are flexible and sort of gnaw away at it to roll with the punch a bit.
Thank you. Well, perhaps in the interest of time, just one last question. Katrina, if you'd like to wait for the microphone behind you, and then we must finish this panel session.
Greg, I was just really interested in mentoring and the ageing workforce. Mentoring seems such a lot of people talk about it, but I was just a bit more interested in hearing a bit more about it and whether what success looks like with mentoring, or, you know, what sort of outcomes you've had.
I guess success is that my mentees know which direction to go in the organisation. They don't head off in the wrong direction. But on a, I guess, more serious response, it's really an issue in that in dealing with any complex task, there is a lot of tacit knowledge involved. We simply can't codify everything. And if we could, nobody could ever read it. So that would be self-defeating. Therefore, we hire skilled people, we put them through lots of training, but you still go through an apprenticeship, in effect. And it doesn't matter if you're a tradesperson, you're still going through another apprenticeship, and that's working with your trade in an interactive way with other trades and engineers. And if you're an engineer, you have an apprenticeship. And that is best handled in the way that it's been best handled for a long, long time, interaction between the younger people and the older people. And I don't know that we need to say that being a mentor and a mentee works in one way. If you are hiring bright young people, I believe they bring new ideas. They may be overtly bringing new ideas to you, or they may be simply doing it through challenging the way you're doing it. So, well, you do it that way, but why? And you should be able to say why. So mentoring is actually something that works both ways. The mentor should get something from the people that he or she is working with. But it's not a particularly sophisticated science, so to speak. It's an old-fashioned way of working with people.